Do you know, sometimes the SWA can be a little bit on the defensive side when it comes to protecting Scotch whisky. So defensive, in fact, that even if it contains Glen in the title of the whisky, they will object. However, one of the whiskies we're going to look at today has got Glen in the title, and yet the SWA did nothing about it, and for good reason. Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of the Malted Muse podcast. If anybody wants to contact me, as always, you can do so. The email address is jim@themaltedmuse.com, or you can do it through the website www.themaltedmuse.com, where there's some more information, some links, and of course a contact form. Now, something that has been on my mind recently is the question of whether the original inspirations behind the distillery affects the finished product. It's just that I am aware that there is a difference between the origins of many old distilleries and those of new distilleries. Many old distilleries have what some may call a shady past, their origins dating back to a time before licensed or legal distilling. These were once small, portable stills that secretly operated away from prying eyes. The raw materials would have been variable in quality, and the finished product would have been harsh, raw, and very young. It would have been made out of need, a need to make extra money, and a need to feel warm and escape a hard existence, and possibly a need to show a defiance towards a seemingly divisive and punishing government. This is where much of the Irish and Scottish whisky we drink today has its roots. Yet there are others whose history is different. Take Indian whisky, for example, a whisky whose domestic form includes spirit made from molasses. This prevents it from being accepted for export by definition, and has caused objections from groups such as the SWA about it being called whisky at all. The irony is that there are claims that it was in fact the Scots who first began to make whisky in that way in India and called it whisky themselves. Today, the origins of new distilleries come not from illegal beginnings, but from other inspirations. Now, I'm not saying that illegal distillation doesn't take place nowadays. In fact, I know that it does. But the reasons for it and the scale of it are very different. Today, the origins of a new distillery come from a different place. But I want to be clear, I am talking about new distilleries, not old distilleries that are being resurrected, but brand new distilleries. The new distilleries of our generation are more likely to be the result of company needs. Existing distillery companies who recognise that they have a product shortfall and need to fill it by the creation of a large distillery, or who see the gap for a type of whisky to meet blending needs, etc. Now, this may sound cold and heartless. Maybe it is. But I like to think that most of the time, within these companies, there is still a passion and a space for the craftsman and the artisan to exist. There are those, however, whose origins are very different. These are the smaller bodies, sometimes the individual. Now, unfortunately, legislation about still sizes means that the UK is less likely to create such projects. The English Whiskey Company, for example, initially intended to be a micro distillery, but was forced into bigger plans due to legislation. Other countries are able to have more flexibility regarding still sizes and also length of maturation. Anyone starting a distillery from the start has to factor in this reality that in the UK and Ireland it has to mature 3 years before it can be sold as whisky, and even then it would be seen as being very young and would have to compete on the shelf against old, more well-known names with huge marketing power. It is a massive, time-consuming and expensive operation. As John Glazer from Compass Box once said to me, you have to work out all of your costs, estimate how long it will take them, and at least double both figures. Now, in my short experience so far in trying to bottle independently, that experience easily supports that advice. Easily. Despite all of this, there are a range of small craft artisan distilleries that are emerging, and they are doing so for a variety of reasons. In future episodes, I'm going to try and find out about some of these and tell you about them. These are small time affairs who are not geared up nor aiming for a global market. In fact, some deliberately resist it. These are places that are trying to hold on to tradition or experiment with brand new concepts. They are trying to recreate past tastes and practices, or are trying to be cutting edge. They are trying to rebel against the large commercial world, or are trying to find a place in it. Whatever they are doing, they are the modern day version of the illicit still. They are not illegal, but they are small, creative, struggling, but passionate. They are built on desire to create, and most importantly, they have, by this process, unique character. And to me, that is vital. Now, I am not going to put Scotch in general down, nor Irish, nor American, but none of them own whiskey. I think that whiskey comes from inside. It may be seen as Scotland's national drink, and there is no doubt that Scotch whiskey is. But whiskey itself is global. It is the spirit of creative independence, born from need and treasured by the working man or woman for generations. The spirit of whiskey was born from the souls of those with small stills, no matter where they were, and this spirit can be found around the world. Now, I am not knocking the big companies, because they do a fantastic job. I love their product, and we would be lost without them. But I also love the independent, and without their spirit, we would also be lost. So occasionally, I will try and feature such distilleries in this podcast. And this week, I'm going to look at two of them. The distilleries I'm going to look at this week began in different ways, different inspirations, and for different reasons. The first I want to look at has now closed. A very small and unique distillery that produced Glenbucket. Now, Glenbucket may sound a little bit on the Scottish side, and often the SWA would pounce down and say, that sounds Scottish, you can't market under that name. But they didn't on this occasion. In fact, not only didn't they couldn't. even though it is German, or rather it was German, because you can't get it anymore. And it actually went by different names as well. It wasn't only known as Glenbucket. And so far, you may notice I've not actually said that it's a whiskey, and I'm not going to. In fact, I'm going to say that it is a spirit, and I'll be careful about that, as there's no way that it actually could be called whiskey, because it fails to meet the criteria of definition in many ways. So why am I including it in this podcast? Well, the reason I include it is because it was made for reasons that sum up much of what I talked about earlier. Glenbucket, despite its Scottish-sounding name, was not a product of Scotland, but was produced in Germany, or to be precise, Saxony, or to be more precise, in Colditz Castle, or Offlag 16 as it was then known. This is a prison of war camp that held prisoner those who were in need of special observation, those who had attempted escapes before and needed a more secure setting. It is a subject of the Second World War that has had much written about it, as well as films and a brilliant TV series that I have got fond memories of watching with my father and my grandfather when I was younger. They've made documentaries about it. Books have been written about it. In fact, they've even made a board game about it. The prisoners found and tried many ways of escape: disguises, tunnels, being smuggled out, gymnastic jumping over the wires. They even built a glider with the idea of flying out. Some found more metaphorical escape, such as losing themselves in academic study. Sadly, one at least found escape within mental illness, and others lost their lives in the pursuit of that escape. It was in these constrained conditions, surviving on limited rations, no tools or materials, and the close watch of the enemy guard, that first brewing, then distilling took place. Not that the Germans were totally unaware. In the book Colditz, The German Viewpoint, written by Reinhold Eggers, who became security officer at Colditz, he writes about how the prisoners were more successful at bribing the guards than the guards were at actually bribing the prisoners. And an excerpt from page 168 of his book, in talking about the prisoners, reads: "Occasionally, they would make a straight swap, food for food, chocolate or coffee for eggs or fruit, and so on, and even for alcohol, although this they made for themselves quite successfully in the last 2 years of the war." This was not high quality, fully matured single malt. It was raw and dangerous stuff that could cause temporary blindness, hence the saying blind drunk. Another saying was jam happy, as jam was actually the main ingredient in the recipe. Jam being a term used loosely, as this is more of a turnip vegetable jam than any fruit product. The main distillers were Pat Ferguson, Michael Farr, and George Drew. Now, interestingly, Pat Ferguson, who died in 2004, and George Drew, who died the following year, were prisoners together in Offlag 6B, and escaped from there together. Sadly, they were recaptured and sent to Offlag 7B. Here, they made contact with MI9, and once again, they escaped. Now, upon recapture, they were sent to Colditz. Here they decided to try and support others in their escaped attempts, rather than make further attempts themselves. They were joined at Colditz by Michael Farr, whose family had associations within the gin industry. This, alongside the influence of the Polish inmates, first led them to brewing and then to distilling. The spirit produced faced many problems. The equipment, for example, was not the high standard copper stills of today, but a result of adapting whatever could be found, and this included lead pipes from an unused toilet. The problem this caused was that the distillate was not a clear, colourless liquid, but a white, cloudy substance. Now, this white, cloudy nature may have been a result of calcium carbonate that had been loosened by the bending of the pipes. And that calcium carbonate would have actually built up within those pipes over time, and ironically would have given a protective covering to the lead to prevent that from actually contaminating the water. The other possibility is simply the result of lead carbonate or white lead, not something you really want to drink. A good account of this can be found in Pat Reed's brilliant book, Colditz, The Colditz Story, beginning on page 135. Beer had long since disappeared from the camp, and with the thought of a dreary winter ahead, a few of us put our heads together. With the help of Nicky, who had already managed to procure some yeast from a German, we started a brewing society. Someone unearthed a curious medal struck to commemorate a brewing exhibition. I was elected chief brewer and dispensed the yeast and wore the medal attached to the end of a large red ribbon. When asked by curious goons what the medal represented, I proudly told them it was a war decoration for distinguished service in the boosting of morale. Brewing soon became a popular pastime, and with a little instruction by the chief brewer and his stewards, was highly successful. Soon, at nearly every bedside, could be seen large jars or bottles filled with water and containing at the bottom a mash of sultanas, currants, or dried figs, produced from our Red Cross parcels, together with the magic thimbleful of yeast. Curiously enough, it was eventually found that the yeast was unnecessary, for there is enough natural yeast already on the skins of the fruit to start the fermentation process without assistance. The one difficulty was the provision of gentle heat, because fermentation requires a fairly consistent temperature of about 27 degrees centigrade. This problem was overcome by the simple use of body heat, or hatching as it was called. It was a normal sight to see rows of officers propped up in their beds for hours on end in the hatching position, with their jars and bottles nestling snugly under the blankets beside them. Fermentation was complete after a fortnight. Some of our amateur brewers were luckier than the ordinary run of broody officers in that their bunks were situated near an electric light. Large incubating boxes were manufactured out of cardboard and lined with German blanket. Jars were arranged in tiers, and the boxes and the heat was turned on by placing the electric light bulbs in the boxes attached to lengths of one electric cable. A flourishing commerce in brewery shares arose and combines were started. Soon we were having gay evening parties and started entertaining our fellow prisoners of other nationalities. One day, our brewing association invited a brilliant lecturer to expound the secrets of distillation. Human nature being what it was, we were soon distilling briskly. I tore down a long section of lead piping from one of our non-working lavatories and made a coil, which was sealed into a large German jam tin about 20 inches high. This still became the property of the Brewing and now Distilling Society. Almost every night, distilling began after lights out and continued into the early hours. We worked shifts and charged a small percentage of the resultant liquor for the distilling of officers' brews. I should explain that distillation is merely a method of concentrating any brew or wine. Brandy is distilled grape wine. We named our liquor simply Firewater, for that undoubtedly it was. Over a period of time, we used up nearly all of the bedboards in the British quarters as fuel for our witch's cauldron. Our rows of broody officers looked more odd than ever, reposing on mattresses supported only by a minimum of bedboards with pendulous bulges in between, the upper bunks in imminent danger of collapsing on the lower ones. In vain did the Germans make periodical surveys of the bedboards, even to the extent of numbering them with chalk and indelible pencil. Alas, the numbers were consumed in the flames and did not survive on the boards. The distilling process was an eerie ceremony carried out in semi-darkness around the kitchen stove, with the distillers listening over the cauldron for the telltale hiss of gentle distillation, their flickering giant-like shadows dancing on the walls as the flames were carefully fed with fuel. Distilling required most concentrated attention because the work of a fortnight could be ruined in a minute if a brew passing through the lead coils became overheated and the alcohol boiled away. Distillation takes place between roughly 80 degrees and 90 degrees centigrade. Having no thermometers, we learned to judge the temperature by sound alone, hence our experts and our right to charge a premium for the process. The liquor, as it appeared drop by drop from the bottom of the still, was pure white in colour. It was bottled, and in a very short time the liquor became crystal clear, leaving a white sediment at the bottom. The clear liquid was run off and rebottled. This was Firewater. The white sediment was probably lead oxide, pure poison, but I was not able to check this, and nobody ever died to prove it. With experience and Polish assistance, we produced various varieties which the Poles insisted on calling vodka. We did not argue over the name, but I feel sure that our liquor would never have been a suitable accompaniment to caviar. It took the roof off of one's mouth anyway. It was not long before the British had a good cellar and vintages accumulating. Christmas 1941 looks rosily ahead of us. The Cold It Still is one I find very moving. It is something that came from events that made many heroes, but also many lost loved ones, and immense sacrifices were made. The BBC made the TV series I mentioned earlier. I watched it with my father, but also with my mother's father, someone who remembered the war. It made the stories reachable. They were not the distant, glamorized works of fiction, but were intimate. I read the books as a teenager and again as an adult during a period of prolonged ill health. They provided me with escape, but also made me consider the courage and wonder of these men. Their bravery, yes, but also their creativity and imagination, not to mention their determination. Now my life would have been very, very different without them, and I'll be honest here, I truly thank them for what they did. What they produced from that still was not whiskey, but for me, yet held the essence of whiskey. It was creative, born from need, and defied authority, just as many whiskey stills have done before and since. The second still I want to look at is very different. To start off with, we are no longer in Saxony, but we are now moving to Finland. And we are not in the throes of the Second World War, but in a distillery that was not founded until 2002. The distillery is Tieren Pelli, and the owner, one Anssi Pusing, did not create the still as a way of surviving imprisonment, but as part of the service for his restaurant chain and a development from his pre-existing brewery, which was founded in 1995. In fact, in the early days, the restaurant was the only place one could get this whiskey. Then it became available in state-owned Alco shops, and now an 8-year-old is available, courtesy of www.thewhiskeyexchange.com. Brewing and distilling take place in the Finnish Lake District area in the town of Lahti. The brewery can produce 1,700 litres per brew and 400,000 litres per year. And it should be good stuff. It's won gold medals at the Helsinki Beer Festival, including Best Microbrewery in Finland in 2001 and 2002, and in the Stockholm Beer Festival in 2010. Now, just as Colditz moved from brewing to distillation, so did Tieren Pelli. Using domestic materials and traditional methods, aged for a minimum of 3 years, they have an annual production capacity of around 15,000 litres. Now, this is available as a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, and an 8-year-old. And it is also available for sale by the cask. Oh, that's tempting. Despite its size, it is possible to visit the distillery at its own visitors' centre in Lahti, or to sample it at their other restaurants, which are in Helsinki, Tampere, and Turku. The 8-year-old I mentioned earlier comes in at around £65 for a 50 centilitre bottle, and I was fortunate enough to taste some recently. I found it to have a pleasant amber colour and a nose that reminded me of apple pie. On the taste, it was very soft, with a long finish, sweet and gentle, like a latte coffee with just a hint of chicory. This is a whiskey with a character, and proud to be Finnish. It is bottled at a respectable 43% ABV, and for a whiskey made alongside a restaurant chain, it is little surprise that it was seen to go well with food. The still at Colditz I have known about since childhood. I will never taste its product. When recreated for a TV program in, I think it was the year 2000, George Drew tasted it and gasped the words, "Oh Christ." In contrast, until very recently, I had not known about Tieren Pelli, and so when I saw it at Whiskey Live London, there were two things that I had to do. I had to taste it, and I had to interview Anssi.
Can you tell me who you are, who you're with, and what you've got here at Whiskey Live?
I'm from Tieren Pelli distillery from Finland.
Right.
And my name is Anssi Pusing, and I'm the owner of the company.
Lovely.
And why we are here? We are here because we thought that our 8-year-old whiskey would be good enough to bring into the UK market, and at least to show it over here for the big amount of customers.
So how long have you been going? How long have you been producing whiskey for?
Since 2002.
Right.
So it's quite young in that way. that, and this is the oldest bottling what we have at the moment to offer.
Right, and you said this is how old? This is 8 years old.
Yes.
Years old. Okay. So tell me a little bit about this whiskey, the character of it, how it's been made.
I mean, well, we use a double distillation system, a pot distillery. The basic, the barley comes from local fields and local malting to do it for us. We have fairly good groundwater over in Lahti. Finland is a pretty clear country in that way. And we do it pretty much in a Finnish way, but still sort of like looking after the Scottish heritage in some sense.
Okay.
But I must say that definitely this is a Finnish product from start to beginning.
So is this is a malt whiskey, not a blended whiskey, not a grained whiskey?
No, it's a malt whiskey.
Just malt whiskey?
Yeah, single malt whiskey. Yeah.
So using a traditional pot still method. And what about the cooling part of that? Is that done with condensers, with worms?
Condensers.
With a condenser?
Yes.
Yeah. And okay. What about maturation? What sort of barrels are you using?
We are using American bourbon, ex-bourbon casks, and then we're using ex-sherry casks. And the casks we buy from Scotland, from Speyside Cooperage.
Okay. And what about, where does the maturation take place? Is that with yourselves or...?
With ourselves, yeah. We have a warehouse. We have two warehouses in Lahti where we are at, and we maturate ourselves, yeah.
And what about the climate that you have in Finland? How does that affect the maturation process?
Of course, we have a bit of stronger winters if you compare it to Middle Europe or England. But what we have noticed is that it's not really. It's maybe it's giving a bit of its own effect to the maturation process.
Right.
And haven't seen anything harm about it. At least it's been working fine.
But the coldness of the winter, though, I would think would slow the maturation down, make it a much more gentle
of course we,
process.
The warehouses, what we use, they are warmed up so that the warehouses themselves don't go below zero.
Right.
They are heated up so that they will stay up zero, and so they will be always... It's not freezing temperature, but that's what I mean.
But I know that there's becoming a bit of a world shortage of whiskey.
Yeah.
Is that going to be a problem for you as you're now beginning to expand out into the UK markets, things like this?
I don't think... our production is very, very limited, so what happens in the big market, it's not really our problem.
So you're hitting that niche market?
Yes, yeah. We are in a niche market, like so far, all the bottling what we have done before, everything is sold very quickly, and so we are not really worried about what happens in the rest of the world, because our whiskey has been selling very well.
Yeah, I'm sure it will do. Well, I'm going to go and find a quiet corner. I'm going to give this a good taste. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Well, since that interview with Ansi at Whiskey Live London, I've actually had some more contact with him. In fact, it is through the emails that I've had from Ansi that I learnt a bit more about the setup that he's actually got there in Finland. And just before I was about to put this episode out, I had another email from him, which was in response to me asking him some more personal questions to him about his motivations. And his reply suggests to me very strongly that in the beginning it was more of a personal interest that he had to do with doing more than just making beer, but using local barley and water. He explained to me that for him it's not just a business, and that it's really good to do something totally different, and that the best part of this for him is that he's been able to prove that whiskey can be made in Finland as well. When it comes to future plans, he's wanting to grow the production and make the business even better. Maybe even finding some investor who'd like to invest into it to make it a bigger scale production. And I wish him all the best with this. It was a whiskey that I really enjoyed tasting. Ansi came over as a really nice bloke, and you know what a lovely little setup that they've got going there. So good luck to you, Ansi. Well, thank you for listening to this episode, and I'd also like to thank Ansi not only for the interview but for sending me more information. I often think it is an indication of the passion people have for their whiskey and how much they want to share it when they let me know that little bit more about their products. So thank you, Ansi. Thank you, Ansi, and thank you for listening. And remember, if you want to contact me, please do so. The email address is jim@themaltedmuse.com, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.